We know that a lot of the technological stack of AI systems is open. It's based, funded on open code. And that doesn't solve any of the problems of the black boxes we discussed, of possible harms. I think we need to take the spirit of open source, of openness, but really look for some new solutions.
Welcome to Deep Dive AI, a podcast from the Open Source Initiative. We'll be exploring how artificial intelligence impacts free and open source software, from developers to businesses to the rest of us. Deep Dive AI is supported by our sponsor, GitHub. Open source AI frameworks and models will drive transformational impact into the next era of software, evolving every industry, democratizing knowledge, and lowering barriers to becoming a developer. As this evolution continues, GitHub is excited to engage and support OSI's deep dive into AI and open source and welcomes everyone to contribute to the conversation.
No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.
Welcome, everyone. Today, we are meeting with Alek Tarkovsky, Director of Strategy at the Open Future Foundation, a European think tank for the open movement. He's a sociologist, an activist, and a strategist. Active for a long time in social movements. He's also on the board at Creative Commons. So welcome, Alek, and thank you for giving time to us.
Hello, Stefano. Thank you for the invitation.
Let's start talking about the artificial intelligence, how it's affecting common life, and how are these applications that you see being deployed into society, and how is that affecting real life people?
So we live certainly at an interesting time, a time of technological change, which probably has been the case for as long as I'm an adult, so for 30 years. But there is a sense there's something new, right? That these so-called AI technologies are really different from the previous waves of internet technologies. Now, I think the interesting thing is that you said we can see them. Actually, I think the trick is that in many cases, we do not see them. And there's a lot of also confusion. What is an AI technology? And there's some also confusion between what is already happening and what we're expecting to happen, which I think is typical of these emergent technologies. They function somewhere between, you know, fiction, prototype, deployment, and mainstream, right? That's the curve they're on.
And some magic here and there.
And there's a lot of magic, and a lot of people like to sprinkle a lot more magic than there is. I also like a term that's sometimes used alternatively to artificial intelligence, which is automated decision making. It sounds a bit technical. It, of course, means something different, but I think it's a nice term to deploy. Basically, automated decision-making says there are situations where humans no longer decide about you, that there are some systems that do that. So in a situation, let's say, where traditionally some bureaucrat in the city would decide maybe which school your child will go to or whether you are eligible for some kind of social support. More and more often, this will be done by automated systems, of which artificial intelligence systems are one specific category.
Yeah, but it's really fantastic how that term conveys very clearly what we're talking about. We're talking about a system that is making decisions for you. It's really clear, rather than the magic.
Yeah, I like it because it also connects this conversation, this sort of futuristic conversation on AI with issues we're already aware of. There are many situations where you don't need advanced technologies, but still decisions are made not by humans. There are some cases in Poland where, for instance, decisions about providing unemployment benefits was made by what was dubbed a automated system. There was even a big investigation made by the Panopticon Foundation, and they discovered that the system is actually an algorithm that can be described in a spreadsheet. It was a really super simple system. It gathered input in the shape of 10 questions the public official asked the person applying for the benefits, and churned out some very basic functions to say yes or no. And the question was, so is this okay? Because there wasn't really any AI hiding inside. There was suspicion that there is, but it wasn't confirmed. And I think the answer was, yes, it's still an issue. But more importantly, more and more often, these systems are actually AI powered, right? There is some component of machine learning happening inside. And we should probably expect that in the coming years, there will be more and more such systems.
Yeah, you introduce a very important piece there where you discover that the system in Poland for unemployment actually had a very simple algorithm that it could inspect and was easy to understand and maybe even fix to spot, you know, unfairness or mistakes.
with proper AI systems, that's really not available. It's one of those obscurities that inside neural networks especially are hard to diagnose, hard to investigate, and hard to predict their outcomes too. In these cases, like, we have real life being impacted by automated decision making. How are regulators approaching this issue? Do they know? Are they noticing?
At least in Europe, they do. And I think it's a good time to do it because I believe that these AI systems are not yet deployed en masse. And you make a valid point. That's the big challenge with them. The issues are the same as with all the automation, but the ways of addressing them are a lot more harder because, you know, there's this, I think, beautiful symbol of the black box, right, that hides things inside. And that's exactly the case with their system. Their complexity basically makes them much harder to analyze, assess their impact, and so on. I participated in a study done by Algorithm Watch, a German foundation, called Automated Society, which looked at cases of the deployment of such AI systems in Europe. And to be honest, there aren't too many yet, at least ones that are publicly known. Here, a caveat is probably needed. You don't find them if you look, let's say, in cities, in small companies, in national governments. But obviously, then there are these huge platforms, which we know are extensively and more employing machine learning mechanisms, but in a way that is not really clear. We all use search engines that by now are, it's almost certain, AI powered. We use social networks that filter content, most probably with AI technologies. But again, the black box appears. There's no certainty. So it's a bit of a weird moment. You can both say, no, I don't really see these technologies around me. And you can probably be just as correct in saying, hey, they're everywhere. Any app you choose in your phone, they might be there.
Right, exactly. I mean, from routing and orienting through the streets of an unknown city, calling a cab, you know, I've always wondered how much of my decisions to walk through a street or drive through a street were driven by advertisers at some point. So the doubts remain because we really don't know from the outside. There is no label applied to this application to say this is being influenced by this and that. So you mentioned the European Union seems to be extremely active on the AI front and they published the AI Act. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what that is or what stage it is?
So the AI Act proposal was published last year as one in a series of several regulatory measures, which is really a big European regulatory push on digital, right? We have the recently adopted Digital Markets Act and Digital Services Act, which sort of regulate platforms. We have a whole package of data governance mechanisms, which, by the way, I think do connect with AI conversations. And then we have the AI Act. And I mentioned the study Automated Society, which showed that there aren't that many systems yet deployed because I think it shows this is exactly the right moment to have a conversation about AI regulation. And I'm happy it's happening right now because, as we know, policies are deployed more slowly than technology. You need to give them time. So I think Europe, by passing these laws, is giving itself time. So the question is, of course, what kind of regulation and is it a good regulation? Let's maybe briefly go over the document and what it proposes. Basically, I think the key category there is risk. Really, Europe has been developing an approach they call trustworthy AI. And in this approach, the biggest question for AI to be trustworthy is whether it is risky or not. So the regulation doesn't really cover all cases of AI. It really focuses on two issues. What kind of AI uses or technologies are so dangerous that they should be outright banned? And what kind of technologies or contexts in which they are used are high risk, so are risky to an extent that you really need to regulate their use? And so this is basically what this act tries to do. In terms of the uses that are banned, it's a very short list. It includes subliminal distortion, which is a bit almost science fiction sounding category, but really, and this is interesting, the regulator believes there are uses of AI that sort of can subliminally affect humans and this should be banned. But then the more sort of realistic ones are ban on social scoring, so sort of the mechanisms that usually are described as being deployed in China, where as a citizen you get scored on how good a person you are. These are meant to be banned in Europe. Ban on real-time biometric identification. So basically technologies that take data from all the cameras deployed in urban spaces and that let you identify people in real time. These are meant to be banned, although there are some carve-outs basically for public security. And then the last category is technologies that exploit vulnerabilities. So find some ways maybe to make elderly people do something against their wish, you know, making use of the fact that they don't understand technology. So, you know, these really high-level risks, you can argue whether it's a good list or not. I am happy that Europe is thinking about banning, for instance, social scoring.
That's very interesting. I wonder how it would be classified if you have a 5 stars as a customer. Can you get discount if that would fall into that category, or if it's just the scoring for the government that is prohibited?
I understand that it's mainly for the government, and also this idea that you're starting to combine sources. This is, I think, the big risk that, you know, you have some 5-star rating on how well you party in a club, which I could imagine happening. And then that data is shared with your employer and further on goes on to determine your, I don't know, health portfolio, right? All these scenarios are, I think, the dangerous one. But really, when you say social scoring, the problem is that then someone really gives you a score. You know, there are some information that, for instance, in China, they're considering that the score could determine whether you get a passport, for instance, right? So some basic rights are limited.
Yeah, I've seen similar experiments also starting in some cities in Italy where they were scoring citizens about how well they were behaving in certain settings so that they could get discounts on taxes like trash disposal and things like that. But I don't know how much of AI was involved though, but in any case, very scary propositions.
So the other, I think the broader category is that of the high-risk situations. And here, some things they're considering are use of AI in the context of employment, so all kinds of work-related HR decisions, uses in education and related to vocational issues, so, you know, scoring of students, how well they study, trying to determine who they will be, uses in law enforcement, such as these ideas of predictive policing. You know, there are some sort of high-profile cases from the US where, you know, they attempted to use previous data on crimes and arrests to determine who will commit a crime again. People seem to love this scenario because they come out of science fiction movies, but they really are rife with risks that affect basically basic rights of citizens, right? If a system deems you guilty basically before you commit a crime, I think that's really serious. Another area that's listed as high risk is migration. I live in Poland, where we just had the huge wave of refugees from Ukraine. And I think this suddenly becomes very relevant. These are people, again, who are very vulnerable. And there are ideas how to deploy systems that can really be basically inhuman. And the last category is justice and democracy. So again, a very fundamental issue that you shouldn't toy with democracy using AI technologies.
This is one part of the AI Act. It's about the technologies that are too dangerous.
The whole question is, so what kind of regulation do you introduce? And the proposal comes with a list of some measures that includes, basically, if you wanted to sort of summarize it, 3 things. Impact assessments and monitoring of deployment of these systems. So, you know, that they're not left alone, that someone asks questions, what will happen if I introduce in a school system these technologies? Second thing is transparency. So you mentioned labels. Am I aware that there's an AI system there? Am I aware of its decisions? Can I be maybe told on what basis it made the decision? And the third category is human oversight. So in what situations, for instance, you might be able to ask, hello, I would like this decision to be reviewed by a human, right? Instead of a machine. It, of course, gets more complicated, but basically Europe is thinking that when a use of AI can be called high risk, these sort of regulations start to apply. And of course, the huge debate that started immediately and has been running for the last year is whether these measures are sufficient. There's, of course, a group of people who say, no, we need much harder protections of persons' basic rights. And of course, there's another camp that says these measures will curb innovation too much. And there's a now quite intense policy debate happening on this.
Who's participating in these debates? Right? What kind of people, what kind of groups do you feel like in Europe are influencing the conversation?
In a way, it's almost a cliche. Like in most policy debates, you have the industry and the activists. These are two really strongest forces. And I on purpose say activist because I think the challenge with this regulation, like with many digital policies, is that it's very hard to involve everyday people. Europe actually did a very interesting project last year called Conference on the Future of Europe, where it really gave voice to citizens through different means. You could submit proposals online, which then all were taken into account in these so-called citizen assemblies. So these situations where they really selected random Europeans to sort of function a bit like members of the parliament. Of course, they didn't pass laws, but they agreed on a set of recommendations that were sent to the European Commission, that the Commission promised at least to look at them. And what happened there, which I think is very telling, is that people were given really a broad range of issues. You'd be happy to hear that there was a lot of proposals on open source policies that was somehow very strong. But ultimately, the outcome showed that average European really gets the message about privacy. There was an ask for privacy to be respected. And still, the basic issue of providing access to internet and technology is for people important. But other than that, they didn't mention any of the things that are being regulated. They don't mention platforms. They don't mention AI. They don't mention data. Why? I think it's just too complex. So this role is played by civil society activists who are mainly digital rights activists. So the policies they focus on are those that will protect basic rights, protect citizens. And I think they are a very strong voice in the debate. Obviously, industry is the other voice, which has a very, I would say, by now obvious line. Usually they say regulation is bad. I don't think anyone in Europe now will say that no regulation of AI is good. And I think the sort of these extremely risky scenarios, there's agreement they should be banned. But then the industry is very quickly ready to say that some of the measures around transparency, around disclosure of how it works, is just gonna be challenging for innovative business in Europe.
Deep Dive AI is supported by our sponsor, DataStax. DataStax is the real-time data company. With DataStax, any enterprise can mobilize real-time data and quickly build the smart, highly scalable applications required to become a data-driven business and unlock the full potential of AI. With AstraDB and Astra Streaming, DataStax uniquely delivers the power of Apache Cassandra, the world's most scalable database. With the advanced Apache Pulsar streaming technology in an open data stack, available on any cloud.
DataStax lives the open source cycle of innovation every day in an emerging AI everywhere future. Learn more at datastax.com.
No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.
It looks like Europe is really taking a different stance from the United States, where no such regulations seem to be on the horizon, at least not at this level. I'm glad to hear, because the open source initiative with this research, what we're trying to do is to try to understand what are the frameworks that the same way that we have done with the open source software, we have provided a way to identify what are the basic needs for developers and citizens to enjoy life in digital space. We'd like to have something similar, at least for AI, to say, look, we can innovate, we can do regulation. We should really pay attention to these specific acts. And it seems like there are some interesting patterns that are already emerging from these early conversations we had, where we want to be able to inspect, for example, the models and understand what these AI systems are really suggesting. Why are they coming with some decisions? And then, so we'll need to keep on having this conversation. It's not going to be simple to solve. And in fact, you know, at this point, it would be interesting to understand, since these are new technologies and they're being introduced now in the markets and they're being regulated, can you make examples of past regulations that have impacted new technologies as they were coming in?
In Europe, of course, when you ask that, everyone immediately thinks of GDPR, the regulation that sort of provides data protection rules. And I think it's been adopted over 5 years ago, but it's a very good time to see what happens. Such regulation, you have to be really humble about the change it causes, right? It's not easy to implement. It requires a lot of effort for it to bring to life. And everyone is willing to admit it. Sometimes it backfires, right? So even a very simple thing, there's this sort of technical term that's thrown around in European policy debates, which is harmonization of law. And basically what this term says is that we have in Europe, you know, almost 30 member states, each one with the different law systems. And sometimes the EU passes laws that are, you know, unified for the whole of EU, but sometimes the way it works is that they pass a directive which then gets sort of adjusted to the local context. But then you can get to a point where you're thinking you have one rule, for instance, for giving consent or for regulating AI in education, but you'll soon find out that it actually works completely different in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. And you get into some huge mess that's a challenge for any company that tries to build pan-European business. It's a challenge for citizens to understand. It's a challenge for policymakers. So then you have simple lessons learned, like try to harmonize it and try to have unified rules. But with this AI regulation, I think what is really interesting, and maybe this goes back a bit to your question about who's present in the debate, that what I'm really interested in is these rules for high-risk situations, but are rules that are not just meant to protect citizens. I think there's rightly so, a lot of debate that basically asks the questions, how are we going to be safe? How will our rights be protected? But I think there are more questions that need to be asked, and which open source communities or open content communities are very good at asking, which is, how will we make this technology productive in a way that is at the same time, you know, sensible, reasonable, and sustainable? And I think this is the space where this question should be asked when you think of things like impact assessment or transparency or labeling. Because I think you can use the same tools, interesting ideas like, let's say, registers of AI systems in one approach that are just meant to limit this technology, right? A technology that is seen as risky, maybe even dangerous. But from a different perspective, it simply creates a framework in which you can ask questions, how can this technology be used well, right? Because I think this is something that sort of can be forgotten when we only talk about risks, that there are positive uses of these technologies. There's a huge promise that we can find ways of using data to the public benefit. But it requires smart regulation.
Right. We've heard of AI systems that are now capable of folding proteins or predicting how proteins fold, so that these are already helping researchers in biotech industry to investigate some more promising paths. So the machine is not really telling how to solve the biology problem, but it's giving paths that seems to be more promising. So it has some risks, and in fact, but there is some very helpful and very interesting technology in there. And what you were saying, as open source and open content communities, what we are very good at doing, it's been for many years, we've been capable of doing that, it's to find good uses and put the good technology into the hands of many developers, many content creators.
And I think the trick here is that the goals are the same, but probably we need to think about new tools, right? I come from a tradition of open content, of Creative Commons, which borrows heavily on the open source philosophy and methods, and basically deploy this most basic, but also extremely functional tool, which is an open license, right? A licensing mechanism has really been solving a lot of issues around access, around sharing of content, of intellectual property, of code. But I think this is why this debate about AI is interesting, is that at some point it shows the limits of just saying open it up, right? We know that a lot of the technological stack of AI systems is open. It's based, funded on open code. And that doesn't solve any of the problems of the black boxes we discussed, of possible harms. I think we need to take the spirit of open source, of openness, but really look for some new solutions.
Absolutely. It's the very basic difference that I see is that code and data are very, very clear, very clearly defined and very clearly separated in the context of traditional software. But when it comes to AI, then data becomes an input to a model. The software becomes something that consumes that model. And they get entangled in a new way that we need to explore and understand more. And we need to help the regulators to understand that too, because it's early. There are very few activists that probably understand exactly what's going on inside these systems. And the impact is also different.
Which brings us to the issue of capacity, which I think is important. And, you know, these policy debates in Europe often, I think they focus so much on the law itself, is that they give a sense to the participants of the debate that really the issues get solved by law, by regulation alone. And I don't think it's true, because one thing that law is very good at is, for instance, protecting and reducing harms, that one thing that's very hard to do with law is building capacity. You cannot pass a law that says, let's have greater capacity in the public sector to understand AI, to deploy AI, to cooperate on shared systems that are open source and have machine learning inside, which I think is the scenario we'd like to see. And that's why there's always the second side of policies, which is about funding policies, research policies, which is sort of a completely different field, right? But I think they should be seen together, because I think the challenge I'm sure all of the world faces, but Europe in particular, is how to add these added capacities. We know that these systems are deployed a lot faster by commercial actors. Regulations like the AI Act aim to, which is I haven't mentioned, but the interesting thing, they're targeted at those who develop and deploy these technologies. So not at the users, but basically at the creators, at the companies, for instance, from which public sector will most probably lease these technologies in some public-private partnerships. So this is one side of the equation, this idea that you need to look sort of what business does with these technologies. But then we look, let's say, at the public sector. And if you think about this list of high-risk areas, if you hear about things like education, vocational training, a lot of this is public, right? Sort of if you try to picture a school system. I really like to think about education and think about the skills of people there, not just in an individual school, but let's say the city level school system, maybe even in the ministry. Really, their capacity to deal with complex system is low. And unless we raise it, they will basically be dependent on vendors. And of course, you can have a scenario, and this is sort of the AI Act scenario, where you then regulate the vendors to make sure they do good. But I'm really also interested in scenarios where we think about how do we build the capacity, right? How do these open source systems can be deployed in communities of, you know, in the case of education, okay, it's a bit hard to imagine that educators themselves will do it, but maybe there can be some specialized units and experts within the system who have the capacity to understand these technologies and to work with them.
So you mentioned that among of the various conversations, various regulations that the European Union has deployed, there is one that is focusing on data. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's connected.
Indeed, that's connected, but not too many people mention that policymaking is such a siloed endeavor. So you have the AI crowd and then you have the data crowd. And of course, there's some overlap, but it's as if it's two different realities. And in the end, obviously, AI is fueled by data. So Europe has a European strategy for data, which has several really bold elements. And ones that I find interesting because they sort of break with the logic that basically the markets will solve everything, and the logic that you can treat property as data. So there's an act that has already been passed called the Data Governance Act, and one that's currently being discussed called the Data Act, which has some really bold ideas. Behind them is this concept called common data spaces. It's still a bit vague, but basically Europe envisions that in key areas, let's say health or transportation industry, you will have these interoperable, shared digital spaces in which data flows between different actors, probably both private, public, and civic. Maybe not completely openly. This will for sure not be open data. Maybe not necessarily for free or in a freemium model, but nevertheless, also not in a model where everything is licensed and under proprietary control. So this seems to be really influenced by ideas like the commons. Of course, the term here is used vaguely, but basically where there's some sort of governance, some sort of management of data as a common good, as a shared good. As I said, the outlines are not clear, but I think this is a really fascinating idea. You know, we get fascinated mainly by technologies. AI is a fascinating term, but sometimes these setups proposed by policies, I think, are just as fascinating.
So also, it looks to me like Europe is the only country that has sort of ratified the right to data mining. Is that in the Copyright Act?
It is. Yes, in the Copyright Directive.
Right. Can you briefly highlight the right to data mining?
So that's another piece of the puzzle that comes from a different silo, but in the end fits right into the AI conversation, because basically the term data mining describes a lot of what you want to do with AI. You want to take a pile of big data and run all sorts of computational techniques that will give you new insights and new knowledge. And these are increasingly methods that could be branded as AI, but are traditionally called text and data mining. And this has been the big debate in the copyright directive. So this has been framed as an intellectual property issue, because the basically what it tried to solve is this challenge. There's a lot of data available today, but you're not allowed to use it, right? You can almost even scrape it from the internet, but someone might have copyrights to this data or some other kind of rights. The rules that were adopted are not broad enough to my liking, mainly because they limit this to non-commercial research activities and institutions, right? So it's good for scientific research, and it's a much needed freedom that basically universities and other research institutes need. But again, if you put together all these ideas about what we could do with data, if we ensure access to data, probably this regulation could have been broader. But I think within this new European data strategy, of course, there's always a question how these rules will play together, but there are some new ideas how data will be shared. For instance, there's a really strong proposal that could make producers of IoT devices, electric scooters, voice assistants, be required to share data they collect, which could open up, you know, really a huge possibility to create really new uses and would really transform this market. Text and data mining, I think it's a term that really strongly connects basically with research, while these other approaches don't really focus on research, but also look for other ways of using data.
So in the end, the copyright directive is allowing for data to be open by default for the purpose of data mining, but only for non-commercial purposes and research purposes.
For research, yes. Which always is the same question. It's a big shift. It's better than nothing, but is it big enough? I think the problem with policies, with the copyright directive that's finished, with these ongoing acts like AI Act, is that you have a sense that these are once in a generation situations, right? Basically, once 20 years, you can expect this to happen. The Digital Services Act that just was passed builds on top of the so-called Information Society Directive, which is now 20 years old, exactly 20 years. So if you think that you have a chance once in a generation, you really would like to get it right. And the bigger challenge, you'd really like it to be future-proof, because you want your law to work in a reality where, you know, technologies are deployed almost every year that can change the balance of things. And this is maybe the big question, also the big debate. It's one thing whether you get the rules right, but I think in almost every act, you need to put these provisions that make it future-proof. So, okay, you might have a list of four scary uses of AI, but do you have a process for reviewing it? Will you in 3 or 5 or 10 years come back and review that list or review your mechanisms for transparency? I think if you don't include that, there's a high chance that basically technology will make your law obsolete.
Right. It's a fine balance to maintain future-proofing versus allowing innovation and regulating. So from the perspective of the industry, so members of the Open Source Initiative and industry members, advocacy groups and individuals, what do you think we should be doing?
Well, first of all, you should engage in these policy debates. I hope that's clear. I think some companies see these issues, but basically it requires probably some redefining of what it means to be focused on open source, right? It's just one piece of the puzzle. It's a very important piece of the puzzle, but I think we also need all to take responsibility for that bigger puzzle. And this applies also to the sort of committee I'm more familiar with, which is the Open Content Committee. By the way, I really appreciate the work done, for instance, by Wikimedia Foundation, which I think has exactly this broad perspective. It thinks of knowledge and content, but it also thinks itself as a platform and engages in debates on platform regulation, but even more broadly often thinks of the whole ecosystem. And I think this is what we all need to be doing, because there's a need to take responsibility for that. And I really also appreciate what you said, that the Open Source Initiative and other industry actors are really trying to understand what openness means in this new technological reality. What does it mean for AI to be open? Because I think it, on one hand, requires reinforcing some well-tested recipes. Open sourcing code is a really good idea, I think. But on the other, it really requires some creative reworking of what it means for things to be open.
Have you thought about it? What does it mean to be open for you? Like, what would be your wish for an open AI?
We are actually doing a project, maybe that's worth mentioning, where we're looking at a very specific case, and a case that has been close to my heart, but also really important for the open content, for the Creative Commons community, which is a case of AI training data sets. It's a story that's by now almost 10 years old. It's a story of huge numbers of photographs of people being used to build data sets with which facial recognition models and technologies are built. There's a famous or infamous data set called Megaface, which has 3 million photographs packaged into a tool that's an industry standard for benchmarking, for deploying new solutions. And it's also a system that's quite controversial. When you dig deep inside, it's not entirely clear. Consent was given. A lot of people say that even though the formal rules of licensing, of Creative Commons licensing were met, they see some problem. These uses are unexpected, risky. When you look at the list of users of these data sets, you suddenly see military industry, surveillance industry, and people really have some disconnect between the ideas they had in mind when sharing their photos. And yes, agreeing that this will be publicly shared, but you know, usually have a vision of some very positive internet culture. And then you find out that there are these uses that you find scary. And I think it's a case we're investigating because this is exactly what we'd like to see, that we have a discussion about law, but also we have a discussion about social and community norms. Because when you want to address these risks, I don't think you can regulate it all. You can, of course, say what's illegal, but beyond that, you really have to think about standards. So that's one thing I'd like to see. And connected with that, I think we don't have specific solutions for a lot of issues, but there's one way that gives a good possibility of attaining good outcomes, and this is participatory decision-making. So really, I favor approaches that really try to draw in different stakeholders, even individual users, into the process. In the UK, the Ada Lovelace Institute organized so-called citizen panels on the use of AI, on the use of big data, on biometric technologies, where really people express their views on how they would like to see these systems work in their lives. And, you know, they are not experts. They will not give you technical expertise. But it turns out if you explain to them the technology, they come up with pretty reasonable ideas about what kind of world they would like to live in.
No, that's very important indeed, to engage and to talk to regulators. I've learned a long time ago that doing that does not mean getting dirty.
And the other way around, it's great for regulators to also reach out to people and really treat them as partners and not just limit the conversation to some narrow group of stakeholders.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for your time, Alec. Is there anything else that you would like to add that we think we haven't covered?
I'm keeping fingers crossed that Europe will develop one more piece in its fascinating array of new regulations, which some people observe with fascination, some people observe with awe or fear. I think of policies as powerful, as means of world building. We like to think that it's technologists who create the world today, but I think policy has a lot of opportunity to shape the world as well. And I just hope more and more people believe that and engage in policy processes, because they're not only important, but they can also be fun.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Alec.
Thanks for listening. And thanks to our sponsor, Google. Remember to subscribe on your podcast player for more episodes. Please review and share. It helps more people find us. Visit deepdive.opensource.org, where you find more episodes, learn about these issues, and you can donate to become a member. Members are the only reason we can do this work. If you have any feedback on this episode or on Deep Dive AI in general, please email contact@opensource.org. This podcast was produced by the Open Source Initiative with the help from Nicole Martinelli. Music by Jason Shaw of Audionautix.com under a Creative Commons Attributions 4.0 international license. Links in the episode notes.
The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the speakers and are not the views of their employers, the organizations they are affiliated with, their clients, or their customers. The information provided is not legal advice. No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.